at least in my work around cash, I'm like, balances of power. It's like, I'm trying to protect balances of power. That's all. It's not like you get some utopia that emerges from protecting the cash system, right? It's just that you prevent a dystopia from emerging at some level.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. In this episode, I talk with Brett Scott, author of The Heretic's Guide to Global Finance and Cloud Money, Cash, Cards, Crypto, and the War for Our Wallets. He also runs the Substack, Altered States of Monetary Consciousness. Brett does a lot of work supporting the protection of physical cash, and I reached out to him about an article he wrote, The War on Informality, which explores the implications of financial surveillance by credit cards and banks. Now, this episode is very thought-provoking. We explore the commodity theory of money versus credit theory of money, power dynamics, the importance of cash, and more. Brett offers some interesting critiques of certain Bitcoin narratives and provides some alternative frameworks for looking at how money works. In particular, the credit theory of money sent me down some rabbit holes thinking about how money comes into being as a future obligation and how this theory could map onto Bitcoin, which has cemented my thoughts around the critical role of Bitcoin mining and energy use, where the underlying Bitcoin and energy are both required to be spent to participate in the network. I hope to explore this a little bit more in future episodes, but for now, please do take a listen and make up your own mind. Brett has been involved in the Bitcoin world for a long time, and I think his arguments and critiques are worth interrogating. If you have any questions or feedback, please reach out. My emails are always open, hello@thetransformationofvalue.com. Otherwise, on to the show.
I was actually hanging out with a German guy recently and sort of talking about the situation a little bit in other areas, and certainly Europe more broadly. You might be familiar with the Mika framework that's come out recently around cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, unhosted wallets, and all of the paraphernalia that goes with that. And sort of, yeah, he explained it to me, you know, in terms of the move forward into this kind of new world of something like Bitcoin. Europe is kind of the last carriage on the train. Japan's maybe third from the end. And then there's other countries that are leading that. But certainly, it seems like there's a lot of repression around alternative ways of doing things, innovation in the space of money, which is certainly something you write about quite a lot. And it was quite interesting for me hearing about that sort of from the outside about what's happening in Europe.
I mean, I don't follow the Mika stuff, to be honest. So I don't really know what's going on in that space. But yeah, I mean, it's got its issues.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be worse.
Yeah, it could be. But hey, Brett, where are you originally from?
South Africa.
Yeah. Like, just has that, I mean, you grew up there. When did you leave South Africa?
Yeah, I grew up there. And so I guess I left in 2008.
Yeah.
So I worked in the financial sector from 2008 to like 2011. And then stayed in London for another 7 odd years or whatever. Yeah. And then moved to Berlin.
Yeah, interesting. Because I reached out to you about your article, The War on Informality, which I really found interesting. I've just been reading through it again. And I wonder, I'd be interested to hear sort of that the background of South Africa and how that's informed sort of where you've got arrived at in terms of your views on money and sort of some of the things we're seeing unfold, but also 2008, I mean, we're talking about the GFC and the Occupy movement and a few things that happened and took place in London as well. So do those things map onto each other? How did those all connect?
Have we started, by the way?
Yeah,
matter of interest.
We're into it, man.
Okay.
You can put on your serious face now. No, it's all good, man.
And I wasn't sure if this was still, how to start with South Africa. I guess like, look, the reason I went off to London in basic terms was I mean, I come from a left-wing background, right? At least not from my family, that's how I became, right? My family, that wasn't my family background. South Africa is an incredibly conservative place, right? Especially when I was growing up there in the end of apartheid. So you're talking about an authoritarian, essentially a fascist government, right? A racist fascist government. And I always, I mean, you know, when you're a kid, you can't really express that very easily. It's just sort of like you're immersed in it. And, but it's something that I always felt like weirdly out of place somehow, like there was something weird in the environment there. And so I, at some point, in a weird way, I kind of, you know, I don't know how much I'm reading into this, but my, you know, starting to look at the sort of global financial system and stuff like that was almost like, you know, if I can't do anything in my home territory, if I don't feel like I have anything to sort of contribute in my home territory, maybe I can like look elsewhere into the broader world, right? So I became very interested in like global capitalism and the sort of processes of exploitation at a much larger level. And so my expedition to London to work in the financial sector was very much like, I want to go and discover how the system works. Like de facto, that's what I was doing, right? I arrived in London to being like, I want to see how this kind of grotesque, well, what a system that I perceived as quite grotesque, how it works, what goes on inside the big finance world and the big corporate world, right? So that's how I ended up going to London. So I also have an anthropology background, right? So it's like, as an anthropologist, you're doing a lot of stuff like trying to immerse yourself in different cultures to sort of get the internal vibe of what's going on and see the sort of codes. And so I became very fascinated, like, let me go and immerse myself in the global finance sector. And so that's actually the story of how I ended up from South Africa in London. So that was a very like crude version of the story. But yeah, then I actually went straight in during the global financial crisis, right? So I ended up working in over-the-counter derivative markets. So these are, I mean, giant bets basically on things. And but it was right in the middle of the crisis. So that market was totally like wrecked. So this is, you know, 2008, 2009. And so I actually entered the financial sector at a very moment when it was melting down, which is a whole, it's very quite an interesting experience in itself, right? So, yeah. And so that was my initial like years in London, all around that kind of scene, right? Whilst also being in the counterculture. So I was also, you know, like I'm a left winger, right? I'm basically have like at some level like a Marxist, right? Or at least like an anarchist, a left wing anarchist, right? So although, I mean, I don't know, I'm not like, I don't know how much time you spend around left wing culture, but you know, there's these like factions within it, right? So I mean, I'm not heavily involved in the faction fighting. And so, you know, it's a bit like in the Bitcoin world, we have like these sort of slightly absurd battles between the different like crypto tokens. And everyone thinks it's like incredibly important, these debates around, you know, how different is Bitcoin Cash to Bitcoin and whatever. It's just these like minor like sectarian debates. Like the left wing world is full of that too, right? Like minor sectarian debates between people who are basically the same as each other. All right. And so at some level, I've always kind of had an element of like a foot in that world too. So I mean, working in finance, working in like kind of corporate world, but also being involved in this like political world, right? Which is partly what my kind of blend of stuff comes from, right? And it's, yeah. And then it's like, and so this is kind of, you know, I ended up in London during the financial crisis, doing all this stuff, but also being involved in like the Occupy Wall Street movement or the Occupy London movement and stuff like that. And got involved then and like after that working on basically alternative finance, right? So I was thinking like, you know, what are the different ways we could reduce the power of the financial sector, right? What are the different ways you can build either, you know, do financial activism. So it'd be like taking on existing institutions in some kind of way, or else alternative finance, which is like, I guess, building alternative institutions, right? And so I wrote a book about that in 2013 called The Heretic's Guide to Global Finance, Hacking the Future of Money, which is basically, it was a guide for like civil society activists. So it's like, and at that time, you know, things like cryptocurrency, for example, were still pretty unknown and wasn't a big scene really. So that is, so in my first book, it doesn't really like feature very much. I mean, it features like a little bit. But yeah, and I guess after that first book, I started getting invited a lot more into these kind of tech scenes, right? Because a lot of people in the tech industry wanted to also imagine themselves as being like taking down the big boys of finance, right? Especially in the fintech scene, which was like growing up in London at that time. So I started getting invited into the fintech scene, right? And I think, you know, you read this article that I did. It's what you contacted me about, this war and informality article, right? And in that article, I'm tracing how, you know, a lot of these like fintech players and stuff started off with this like rebellious narrative that they were somehow like democratizing finance. But in reality, what we've actually seen over the years and, you know, in places like London is actually that they're basically just acting to extend the power of like massive big tech companies and big finance companies, right? Yeah, so I guess feel free to interrupt me at any point. I don't know.
No, no. it's okay. So just if I can pick on a couple of threads there. So I found it interesting. You mentioned the left-wing Marxist thing because, you know, it was almost a confessional the way you said it. But like for me, that rings with sort of my background from New Zealand. And by the way, what part of South Africa did you grow up in?
Durban.
Durban, yeah. So, you know, where I was in Wellington, New Zealand, you know, it's extremely left wing. It's sort of, you know, I remember walking down Norway Street and there's, you know, the spray painted, you know, Russian imperialism, you know, it was sort of just out of the blue, some students had done that. And it was sort of this classic trope in New Zealand. But at the same time, with my work looking at Bitcoin, looking at Austrian economics and some of these other things, I don't think they are incompatible. And similar to yourself, there's a way to almost be a provocateur within the system and to see it in a different way. And so I think that's very interesting. And you can look at the relationship between, you know, you talk about the factions. And I think I would probably characterize it more within Bitcoin specifically. I think other cryptocurrencies are, you know, a waste of time. But within Bitcoin, there is a lot of infighting. You know, what is Bitcoin? What you know, what is the right way to do things?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And there's a free market for ideas there, which is, you know, Bitcoin is what people choose it to be. So it's sort of there. But the process of going through that, you know, what updates get made to Bitcoin? Ultimately, it rejects certain things, and those fork off and fail generally, or always fail. And then you've got the thing that continues, which is Bitcoin. And so it's sort of, we often think about the capital B and the lower B Bitcoin, you know, the network and the technology. And I think that's quite connected here because you talk about these, you know, Revolut and these kind of tech, fintech startups that sort of try and put the middle finger to the man. But at the same time, they eventually get co-opted necessarily by being within the spectrum of global capitalism and kind of corporate capitalism as we see it. So is that just an inevitability that if you're working within the paradigm of modernity, of corporate capitalism, that you will be captured at some point?
I mean, it's a strong tendency. Yeah, I mean, there's a few threads there. I could say stuff about the connection between Marxism and Austrian economics, because actually in the money world, they actually kind of sort of semi agree with each other. I don't have a Marxist position on money for the record. But that's like, they can park that to the side as a esoteric debate. But the, yeah, like the fintech world. And yeah, I mean, like when I'm looking at, one thing my sort of structural political economy Marxist-y stuff does is when you're analyzing economies, you don't assume that individual actors really have any power, right? Like, this is something that like libertarians really struggle with. Like, and of course, if you're in the Bitcoin scene, you're gonna hang around with a bit of libertarians, right? Like, libertarians have got this really weird sort of like, I guess like methodological individualist position, right? They kind of believe that that individuals somehow determine systems at some level. Whereas, you know, in a structural political economy analysis, you look at like vast systemic forces that are much more powerful than individuals, all right? So, you know, entrepreneurs in the fintech scene in London, for example, they'll have these like heroic self-images and narratives they tell themselves. They're like, oh, I am out here, you know, I'm going to take on the global financial system and my startup is going to do it, right? And then at some point, there's an almost evolutionary process in the system where if they don't mold themselves to the needs of the system, they basically get destroyed, right? So the ones who succeed will be the ones who are the most prepared to adapt themselves to the systemic forces that emerge from a market, right? And this is what partly gives the sort of like cognitive dissonance to the entrepreneurial scene, right? Because at the one hand, they'll have this sort of self-image of being heroic individuals, right? So be like, they'll kind of like want to believe that they create things. And if they weren't there, somehow this thing wouldn't exist. So let's, for example, take like in that article I mentioned, like Nutmeg, which is this like automated investment manager in London, which I used to like, they used to hang around the scene I was in, right? And Nutmeg was like, we're taking on the banks, we're going to democratize finance. And they all like looked cool and stuff, right? And in that, in their mind, they had this whole like, we're a heroic team that's going to like take on the big boys, right? If you go to London now, Nutmeg's been bought by JP Morgan. It's been subsumed as a kind of powerless unit within it. The CEO has been paid off and he's now on like gardening leave, right? Because he's basically sold out. So they're owned by the banks that they then claimed that they were going to take down, right? And the thing is like, in some ways, like if Nutmeg hadn't done that, they would have gone bust at some level, or they would have like faded away, right? So in an almost evolutionary sense, they were like, and this starts to sound a bit too determinist for me at some level, right? But you can see how the heroic entrepreneurial narrative at some point pivots, or some point like molds into like, oh, well, we were always planning to actually like, you know, get incorporated into JP Morgan, right? And so like you'll find this happens a lot in these scenes where the sort of the narrative of the entrepreneur slowly shifts as they, you know, they sort of start out with this rebellious story, and then later they kind of like become sensible, as it were, right? And they start being like, well, actually, you know, it's much more impactful to be working, to be part of JP Morgan and so on, right? What's really going on there is that in a large scale system, and you know, if you're not following the systemic forces, it's going to be much harder for you, right? So if Nutmeg tries to go it alone, they're going to be relatively disadvantaged, right? So it is possible that they can do it. It is possible to stand against the systemic forces, but it's much harder, right? You even see this in the crypto scene, right? Early crypto people had all this heroic rebellious narrative constantly. I watched them sell out one by one, right? It's firstly like started with the like them like moonlighting as consultants for like corporates on the side, right? So all the kind of crypto entrepreneurs would be like, yeah, well, we have our crypto startup, but then we're also going to like, you know, go and like do some consultancy for KPMG or something to tell them about blockchain 2.0 or whatever it is, right? And then eventually they all just started collaborating. A lot of them just started collaborating with the powers that be, right? Because they can make more money like that. And then actually so you can kind of like slot into the system in an easier way. But there are some people in the crypto scene who kind of like rebel against that, right? Like it's kind of interesting, for example, like maybe I'm just riffing too much here, but like Jesse Powell from like Kraken, for example, like he kind of tries to like make an effort to sort of keep up the political purism of his like libertarian position in the face of like global capitalism. So I'm kind of like waffling on here, but I sort of believe that you know, that you have some degree of agency within the global economic system, but like not a huge amount.
So just taking that point, you talk about crypto more broadly. I mean, I'm interested. And there's a certain layer that you can zoom out to a certain point, and this is sort of where I've arrived at, where you can see broadly what I call the impact of fiat. And this is sort of anything that touches the existing financial system, it eventually succumbs to these evolutionary pressures you talk about. And, you know, you start to see it. And I had some notes here. You might be familiar with the corporate Memphis art style, you know, the way they talk about things, the kind of the gentrification of revolutionary rhetoric. You know, they use imagery, they use marketing to make it seem hip and cool, but ultimately it all exists and is pocketed within this this framework, whatever, you know, and I call it fiat, but there is something there. And in the same sense, and I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on the kind of the differences between something like Bitcoin and crypto, because for me, certainly there's a clear difference where the fundamental financial revolution that's taking place is the building of a new financial system upon Bitcoin. And crypto, more, you know, quote unquote, which includes everything else, is everyone who's trying to make it seem like that. They're LARPing as punks, but then they go and work for KPMG to do a consulting gig on the blockchain and some smart contract bullshit. Have you got a position or thoughts on Bitcoin versus crypto and sort of...
I mean, I don't really, I'll be frank with you, I don't actually care about that debate at all. I think that's a debate you care about if you're like heavily in that scene, right? I mean, just like practically, a lot of the people in the so-called, I mean, I don't make a distinction between those terms because in the early days, there wasn't a distinction between those terms, right? That became a thing later in the Bitcoin scene, is to sort of differentiate itself from Ethereum and all the stuff by like being like Bitcoin isn't crypto and stuff. But, you know, I'm from an earlier generation of the crypto movement, so I don't really care in a way, right? Also bear in mind that lots of the people who then went on to become the so-called, you know, well, the non-Bitcoin world came from the Bitcoin world, right? And so, yeah, but in actually the KPMG consultants often were Bitcoiners, you know? So I don't have a particular, part of the reason for this is I just don't have the same monetary theory view as the vast majority of people in the crypto world, right? Of which Bitcoin is part, right? So when I'm categorizing things, I don't use the same framework, all right? So for example, I was involved, I remember getting dragged to the Bitcoin Cash conference in Tokyo, where the very first one was called Satoshi's Vision, right? And this was a point where Roger Ver was trying, who was originally Bitcoin Jesus, right? In the early days of Bitcoin, he was this guy who was like going around like evangelizing, and he was like this like libertarian dude. And, you know, like he was a pretty straightforward libertarian character. And so he had this like initial heroic rise within the Bitcoin scene as being this like hero, and then he started to disagree, and there was this like fork that happened, right? The Bitcoin Cash thing. And they invited me to come along to speak there because I was doing a lot of work on the protection of physical cash, right? And they wanted, in a sense, like somebody to come and talk to, because they wanted to be like, we're the cash of the Bitcoin world, right? And you know, maybe you can come and talk about, you know, like which is more money, like Bitcoin Cash or Bitcoin, right? Because in their world, there was like, we are the money of the Bitcoin world, whereas like the hardline Bitcoin maximalists, they want to create this like investment or something. But to me, I was like, you guys are all the same. You have exactly the same structure. The only things that your differences are these like minor things on like how fast the tokens can move, which is not a structural difference. It's just like a kind of superficial difference, right? The actual difference in monetary systems is like, what are your tokens, right? Are they weird, like commodity, like collectibles, or are they like IOUs, right? Like credit money, right? And that's my background. So a large part of, you know, Bitcoin, Dogecoin, Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum tokens, all of those things in some ways share a common feature, which is that they all basically abide by commodity theories of money. All right, which is why in my head, I don't often make a distinction. I'm like, well, you all basically have the same paradigm, regardless of the specific differences that you have within yourselves. If you are immersed in that paradigm, you start to perceive the incredible large differences between yourselves, right? Because you sort of take that for granted. But for me, I don't, right? Whereas I, for example, would look at stable coins and I'd be like, I will categorize those differently. I don't even see those as being part of the crypto world. Right. I'm like, that's a monetary system that's connected to the banking sector. Right. Mm-hmm. That's not even in the same category at all. So I think that's why I don't find the internal battles that happen inside, you know, Bitcoin versus crypto stuff, I don't find them very interesting or convincing, because I don't think they really help very much in terms of like, well, that they don't say much to me in a way. Does that make sense? I'm not sure.
No, it does. Thank you. And look, that's a really interesting perspective, and appreciating that you were involved with this in the early days and you've seen these things unfold. And I think certainly there's something to be said about the situation where we're at today and sort of some of the narratives that have evolved and come to light at where we're at today. But coming back to the money piece, so putting, you know, the crypto Bitcoin stuff aside for a moment, you talk about the commodity theory of money. And I guess when I'm reading, you know, your writing here around the war on informality and all of that other stuff, I mean, Brett, how do you define money, and how do you sort of, you know, situate and kind of characterize the framework of corporate, you know, this thing that we're in at the moment? I mean, what features does it have, and how has it become money?
Yeah, so money, I mean, at a very, very generic level, a system of economic network access tokens. That's a very generic description. I think one thing to say, I don't use functional definitions of money. Like, I refuse to use functional definitions of money. I refuse to say stuff like it's a store of value, medium of exchange. I think this is like a terrible way to, a terrible, like, and very, very common way to analyze money. And it comes from a particular paradigm within economics that's fundamentally flawed. So I don't ever define money by functions. I try to define it by like structural definitions, right? To be like, just actually describe to me what it is. Don't just describe what you think it does, right? So when I say something like a system of network access tokens, that's a very generic statement, right? And that's partly based on a background awareness of what an economy is, right? An economy is an interdependent network of people connected to the earth, right? Who rely upon each other to survive, right? That's what actually value is, right? So I would never say money has value, for example. So I would never, all this like store of value stuff, like people say, it's like, I would just like refuse to use that terminology. When I talk about value, I talk about like, that would be like actually like human beings using their labor upon the earth, right? And then money is a system in a sense that, let's say large scale economies co-evolve with money to create these very large scale networks of people who are interdependent, right? And those units of money in that context are these access tokens to other people's labor, essentially, right? I could go deeper into that. But there's more specific elements of like what those access tokens end up being, right? So you can have, there's different accounts of how you can create network access tokens. So in our current system, the network access tokens actually take the form of credit instruments issued out by at least three layers of issuers, being the nation state, the commercial banking sector, plus a whole bunch of third tier players like PayPal and the stablecoin people. So they're all based. So there's, I see the monetary system, the issuers of those units in tiers. So I have a vertical dimension when I'm thinking about money and a horizontal dimension, right? So the vertical dimension is money issuers, people who push money out and pull it back in, right? And there's a particular logic to the vertical dimension of money, right? It has its own logics that actually operate slightly separately to the horizontal dynamics, which is like when we are passing money between ourselves, right? So a horizontal money, you know, when I say the word term horizontal, I'm like, I actually have visual imagery in my head of like monetary systems. So I'm imagining like a landscape with people on the ground. Okay. So this is the traditional imagination of money. People are being like, well, I pass these units between ourselves on the ground. Right, that's the horizontal dimension. But the vertical dimension is like the issuers that loom above you, and they push money like down into you and suck it back up again. Right, that's what the issuers are doing. So the logic for the issuers is slightly different to the logic of the users of the currency. Right, and this is what like credit theories of money train you to think like. Right. It basically means that there's different logics operating within monetary systems that start to intersect, right? So That's a kind of a very like large sort of broad way of describing it. But then within that, there's like, you know, different not only different layers of money, but also different instantiations of it. So for example, I write a lot about the protection of the physical cash system. The physical cash system is a layer one form of money in physical form. All right. You also have layer one money in digital form. And then we have layer two money, which is like the commercial banking sector, which is what the so-called cashless systems are, right? So that's how I'm thinking about this stuff, right? Do you want to maybe dig into that?
So that's really interesting. And I find it interesting you talk here about you don't define money by functions, but by structural definitions. And I would love to learn more about that, because I've been reading your other piece here, Intro to Economic Life, Creatures on a Planet, which is talking about, you know, basically, yeah, you know, we're all just a network of people, praxeology on Earth doing stuff. And that is, you know, that is the economy. It's not a thing that you measure or cut up or, you know, run formulas on. It is the network of humanity. And there's some interesting things there. You know, you talk about this horizontal layer, these kind of channels between human actors. And, you know, you think the money, you know, for example, paper money, South Africa, Zimbabwe, places like that, the way that value can be extracted off of the paper itself. And so the artifact, the instantiation of that in reality of $1 million Zimbabwe dollar or whatever, it doesn't maintain that value. It gets sucked off vertically due to some of the machinations of these higher tiers, and that's a really interesting effect, because it's not the same as any, you know, other goods. That, you know, what other good does that happen to where the value can be virtualized away and sort of evaporated away?
I mean, I wouldn't place money in the, I wouldn't say it's a good, right? Like so when if you said something like money's a good, it means you've got a commodity way of thinking about money, right? And most people do. 99% of people in the world are trained to think about money as a commodity, even when they know it's not, right? So, and this is actually quite a big problem if you're in the Bitcoin scene, right? Because not only the Bitcoin scene, but like everywhere, but it's a particular problem in the Bitcoin scene, because, you know, if you're interested in like how to design like a system to take down the existing system, you have to be very aware of like, yeah, commodity ways of thinking about money basically just like hamper you so badly.
I'm willing to put that to one side for the conversation. So we take away the good, you know, it's, you know, because there is an argument, you know, that, as you say, that's a common belief that is a good, it should trade on a free market just like any other good. But if we take this network approach where it's an affect of the network, it's a token that is used within this network and it has different physical forms. So this, I mean, if we talk about the history of money, the history of economics, I mean, is this kind of, you know, we're talking about centralized layers here, we're talking about central banks, commercial banks, these kind of institutions.
Sure, sure, sure.
How has that operated historically?
But I think maybe, I mean, like trying to recount the history of money is not something you can easily just like do, but so maybe it's worth like sketching a few like dualisms or like a few sort of like binaries that are useful to just like have some awareness of if you're interested in like so at least from my perspective. So like dualism one, I'd say like a commodity mindset to money or an orientation versus a credit orientation, right? And this, when I say this, this applies to any form of money you're approaching. So when I say a person like has a commodity orientation to money, I'm not saying that they literally think money is a commodity. It's like a metaphorical model that's in their heads playing out while they try to analyze money, okay? So you can apply a commodity mindset whilst analyzing non-commodity money. And similarly, you can apply a credit mindset whilst analyzing commodity money. Okay. I'm not sure that makes sense. So these are like ways of like your sort of starting point of imagining a monetary system. So one of the classic things that's going to happen if you have a commodity style of thinking, which as I said, most people do, is your sort of background way you imagine the economy is as a whole series of individuals with things. Okay. So like your sort of starting point, this is like how an economics textbook starts. Like there's a whole bunch of people and they have things somehow, right? So, and then it's like, oh no, what do they do? They're gonna have to try and like trade these things, right? It's incredibly like anachronistic. It doesn't like, this has never actually existed in any like human economy. You don't just find people with things suddenly. Like, but it's a thought experiment. It's like these like solo individuals who've somehow produced stuff and then they're trying to exchange. It leads then to a certain type of mentality where you're imagining them trying to like convince each other to exchange somehow. And this is why you get this like idea of like money being a value. You sort of try to like induce somebody to give you something by handing something else of value over to them, right? This is where like theories of barter and stuff come from. It's this commodity mentality, right? But it basically starts from an incredibly unrealistic perspective of an economy. You're imagining solo people with stuff, right? And this is where my anthropological background comes in a lot, right? Because like actual economies throughout time never start like that. Actual economies are always interdependent groups of people who can't really survive apart from each other, right? So most early economies are not held together by some weird commodity money. They're held together by systems of informal credit, reciprocity, codes, right? Like, so where people have like, basically lines of credit with each other, right? In some informal sense. And that's you sort of is a sort of starting point of analysis, right? And so when you're looking at an economy, a lot of like the ways when their people are sort of, if you ask a person like, how does a modern economy, like what's going on? They do have a fantasy that what's going on is that like, you have to sort of like convince people to trade with you and stuff. And you have to sort of like, but in reality, this is not an option for most people. If you don't trade, you will die.
Yeah.
You can't survive unless you trade, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like an optional thing. It's not like a voluntary act. It's not like something that you have to convince other people to do, right? You're not, money is not required to like, make a case to somebody for like why they should give you something. If they don't accept the money, they're going to eventually like die.
Yeah.
Right. Cause you're in it. So this is what a credit style of thinking becomes, right? Where like you have that background awareness that actually human societies, you can't exist apart from each other, which then gives you a particular way of thinking about money, right? Because once you drop the idea that money like has to sort of like convince people somehow through its apparent value, like it changes your analysis, right? So if I was looking at Bitcoin, for example, I'd be like, for it to actually operate as a monetary system at some point, it would have to lock itself into that situation. It would have to become the thing where if you do not obtain it, you eventually lose access to everybody else, right? So right now, that's not the case with Bitcoin. Bitcoin right now operates as an object priced within the monetary system. It doesn't operate as the actual monetary system. Right. So if I was doing a kind of workshop on like monetary design, I'd be like, how would you take that object that you have, that cryptocurrency? What would you need to do to actually make it into the network access token? So I mean, I'm kind of maybe get complex right now, but
no, this is good stuff, man. So speaking of that, you might be familiar with David Graeber, Debt. The first 5,000 years, talking about sort of...
I'm very familiar with David Graeber, yes.
Yeah, so I thought that was an interesting take, and it sort of shits on the idea that, you know, barter somehow was the thing, and it never was. It was this idea that you owe someone a favor for them helping you out, and it comes back to praxeology, human action, helping out your neighbor, you know, just keep kind of keeping score, and that is his theory around the emergence of money. And I mean, coming back to something you said earlier around if we look at structural definitions, and there's this kind of meme going around that it's like the purpose of a thing is what it does. And it sort of sounds a bit silly, but it really is important. And I think we may be, talking to Bitcoin in particular, we may be coming into a new space where there's maybe certain narratives or certain visuals that are used to talk about Bitcoin, but actually the way it is being used in reality, you know, that you know, you can't turn away from that. You know, there's the expectation and the kind of theory of what it could be, but then you look at how it is actually being used, Sure. And I think of a sort of a cultural hegemony here, where it's a legacy system, and then there's this kind of other thing that is available. And it's one possible reality is that it's never used by the mainstream, and it exists purely as an alternative system for people who don't want to be in this other thing that we've talked about, you know, this kind of global fiat corporate system. I don't want to be part of that, I didn't have any other real options. And this is something you talk about in the war on informality. How do I tip the street busker without using MasterCard? Cash is one option, which we can talk about as well, but Bitcoin is another option, and then he can then use that Bitcoin how he pleases. So sort of
I mean, there's a few things going here though, right? Like so, okay, just to zoom back, a lot of my work is around how do you protect the balance of power in the existing monetary system? Okay, so I mentioned, forget about like moralistic, you know, takes on whether you like the system or not, right? Like, it's like, if you're going to have that system, you better prevent the most toxic elements coming out, right? So when I'm trying to protect the cash system, what I'm trying to say is I want to, because, you know, the existing monetary system has all these different players in it. You know, when people say fiat money, it's a bit of a meaningless statement. There's at least like 5,000 issuers of like a currency in a particular, in all these different layers, right? So, and the state is just the first layer, right? Then you've got the commercial banks, you have all these other players. So it's an ecosystem of currencies, right? So, you know, the British pound is an ecosystem of different players are issuing different types of tokens at different scales, in different forms. And I'm interested in how you maintain a balance of power between within that ecosystem. So when I'm trying to protect the physical cash system, I'm saying, I'll have these like phrases like cash is the public bicycle of payments, whereas the, you know, your Visa and MasterCard are like the private Uber of payments, right? And you want to maintain a balance of power between the bicycle and the Uber, right? That's all within the fiat system, right? But I'm interested in how you keep that balance of power between public and private, physical and digital within that system, right? Now, the crypto world, especially, I'm saying crypto, when I say crypto, remember, I'm coming from earlier, before all the like pedantic battle period of the blockchain world. Like, so to me, I just sort of generically use that term. The crypto world initially came of age imagining, in a sense, what would happen if that balance of power was destroyed, right? Saying in a cashless society, when suddenly everything is digital and we have a problem, this is why we need this alternative, right? This digital cash as some kind of like external counterpower within that system. Now, within that framing in crypto, you have the like right wing and left wing versions, right? Mostly more conservative, to be honest, right? Where the imagined aggressor is the state, right? So it's like the state wants to take over everything. The state, right? And in reality, the actual cashless systems are run by the private sector. The actual surveillance mostly is done by the banking sector and the tech sector, right? Rather than the state. But in the end, you're talking about an oligopoly structure, which has a fusion of state and corporate power. That's the actual system that we have. That's actual capitalism, right? And then the crypto world has historically imagined itself as this counterpower, right? Now, I do actually support that goal, the counterpower idea. And actually, this is why historically I've dabbled and, you know, been involved in the Bitcoin world and been involved in these different things, because I'm interested in how it can create counterpower. The area where I totally diverge from the crypto world is like the monetary theory, which I think is pretty terrible. A lot of the kind of like unrealistic, or maybe like inorganic ways of viewing power, right? Like the sort of, especially in the libertarian parts, this is like imagination that the state just sort of projects power like some kind of alien invader. Like that gets its like energy from some external source, or some like alien planet somewhere, right? It's like a very classic thing. Like the state is coming to like oppress you. It's like, well, where does the state derive its power from? Like it derives its power partly from the underlying base of people that make it up, right? Like it doesn't derive its power from an external power source. So there's a lot of like weird conflicted narratives going on in the crypto scene, which has historically been why I end up getting classed as being like a crypto skeptic at some level, because I kind of like get irritated with the sort of the rhetoric within that world. But in terms of like the sort of real politic of global finance, I find it useful that the crypto world has developed itself as a partial counterpower. But one of the things I like reject is the idea that it's actually separate to the existing financial sector. If you look at how the vast majority of like, you know, Bitcoin, any crypto tokens, they're actually fused into the existing system. So when I'm analyzing something like Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash or whatever it is, right? I don't take on the same framing. I don't accept the idea that it's like two predators fighting each other, right? Which is often the warlike framing you find in a lot of the crypto communities is like, you know, let's say Bitcoin, like, all right, and be like, we are taking on the fiat system. And I'd be like, no, you're not. You're symbiotic with the fiat system. You have a symbiosis of some sort. It's quasi-parasitic, quasi-mutualistic. And, you know, you both use each other, right? The ecological metaphor to use is not like two, you know, like a lion fighting a tiger or a shark fighting a crocodile. It's like some kind of like symbiosis, parasitism kind of thing, right? And this is how, and that's interesting to me politically, right? Because I'm like, that's actually quite useful. The grafting the sort of Bitcoin system as a sort of weird, like symbiotic life form into the existing system does actually end up having political uses. You can actually like use it in various ways. It's interesting. But a lot of people in the Bitcoin community don't like that narrative because it clashes with their self-image, right? Of yeah. being like on some warpath. That's how I see it.
Yeah, well, I find that it's a very sophisticated argument. And I think that's certainly, there's something to be said about the heroic imagery. And you're talking about earlier just with the fintech people, they have this kind of Joseph Conrad kind of image of the self, you know, they were on this journey to vanquish the demon. And in a way, the narrative could be said, and perhaps it's a useful narrative for certain purposes, but still within the global economy, Bitcoin is one part, and then there's other parts. And the way they sort of interplay and sort of the shifting of the sort of soil beneath kind of the movement, and again, it's a very culturally hegemonic sort of a movement, right? Where maybe ground is given in one area, and then ground is lost in another area. Mm-hmm. You know, somewhere that, you know, Venezuela, somewhere that's failing with its kind of, you know, fiat system, so to speak. Maybe that's where Bitcoin is more popular, and then in a place like New Zealand, where, to be honest, most people aren't interested. It doesn't matter to them, even though they are losing value because of inflation and cost of living crisis and all of that stuff, which is a whole other argument that can be leveled on the state potentially as the cause of that. Still, the everyday person, they're not running for Bitcoin, and so it's sort of, I see what you're saying around the interplay of those two.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm always at risk of talking at cross purposes or talking past, you know, when I'm speaking to people, I'm not saying this is with you, but like with lots of people in, for example, let's say the Bitcoin scene, because this podcast, I think you focus it around that. If there's certain paradigms you need to like, you need to have the same paradigm when you're speaking to somebody, right? Otherwise you start missing each other.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. So this is why I say, you know, commodity mindsets versus credit mindsets. To understand quite a lot of the stuff I'm saying, it sort of helps to know the distinction between those ways of thinking, which takes for a lot of people, it takes quite a long time. But like, you know, another one of the issues in when I'm looking at something like Bitcoin, you know, I just said it's a symbiotic life form in a sense that's fused into, it doesn't really compete with fiat. It sort of like rides on top of it, right? And one of the reasons why this is the case is like also to do with the fact that, well, it's related back to that monetary theory question, which is like, if you have a dynamic credit money system, which is what our actual system is, it'll eat a non-dynamic commodity system. If you have any sort of static, limited supply, commodity-like object, a dynamic credit system will eat it, which is what the fiat system has done to crypto, right? They basically become priced objects within, much like any other priced object. So if you zoom out, Actually, there's really no distinction between, you know, like a mug that I buy and Bitcoin. They're both priced objects in a market. Okay. So that at a very generic level. So actually, technically, if I was categorizing Bitcoin, it's a good within a monetary market. It's not a monetary system used to price goods. Okay. What's interesting about Bitcoin, though, is it's highly swappable, right? It's very, very easy to transfer it. And it's digital, right? Unlike, for example, a mug or some physical object, right? And this imparts upon Bitcoin a property called countertradability, right? Which is you can swap it for other things very easily via its monetary price, okay? So I used to, quote unquote, buy things with Bitcoin a lot. I was never actually buying things with Bitcoin. What I was buying things with what I was using its resale price to buy things, right? And you know this because anybody actually in the crypto scene knows this, because when they're like calculating what the price is, you'll look at the actual fiat price and then you'll calculate, okay, if I had to resell this, how much would I have to resell to get that same amount of money? And that's counter trade, right? That's a counter trade system. You have a highly counter tradable digital object that's priced in dollars, for example, and you're using its counter trade ratio to exchange. And that's an example of that symbiosis I'm talking about. Yeah. Without that price, there's no counter trade is going to happen, yeah, right? If, for example, Bitcoin had no price, people wouldn't know what the counter trade ratio was. They wouldn't know what to like give stuff for. So actually, the idea that it operates independently of something like, you know, US dollar is a fantasy. What it is, it's a digital commodity that's established itself as this like symbiotic form, and it then offers this route of counter trade as a way to get around as a sort of new way of exchange, right? A very simple way to see this, if you go to, for example, El Salvador, which of course has become the place where people will talk about, like if you walked into a restaurant in El Salvador, and the vast majority of places in El Salvador don't actually take Bitcoin, despite the like rhetoric, but let's say that if you go to Bitcoin Beach, right, where they're kind of do that, you know, if you go to a restaurant and you look at the menu, you know, let's say they've written it above the bar somewhere, they're not going to write it in Bitcoin, right? Because they know it's like, it's a counter trade object. It's not a monetary system. What the actual price is the US dollars, right? That's that price stays fixed as you sit eating your meal, right? Let's say it's $20 for this meal. It's going to stay on the menu. It's not going to change during the time of your meal. But the Bitcoin, quote unquote, price will change, right? Because what they're doing is they're saying, how much Bitcoin would you need to sell in order to get $20, right? Mm-hmm. And so they calculate that constantly as the global speculative market changes, which means the actual money being used isn't Bitcoin, it's US dollars via a counter trade object, right? So that's what how the whole system works, right? So when I'm looking at Bitcoin, I'm like, you know, it's not competing. It's not competing with the US dollar. It's using the US dollar. It's like a strange symbiotic life form that's actually like finding interesting ways to get around it, right?
Yeah.
And actually, you can do that with many other objects beyond Bitcoin. You just said, for example, you said about inflation. I used to work in inflation derivative markets in finance, right? So we used to work a lot with big pension funds and stuff who wanted to hedge against inflation. And when you know, inflation is the loss of power in your monetary access tokens, right? So they can command less and less over time, right? And when you're approaching a big fund to say like, you know, how are you going to protect against this loss of power? There's different approaches. So like, historically, what the kind of things we were selling were like inflation derivatives, which are like bets that will compensate you if there's a loss of power. But the traditional approach is you get out of money and you buy a object that you hope will go up in monetary price over time, right? You'll buy land, you'll buy like shares, you'll buy something that isn't money, all right? And you hope that the price goes up so that you can then resell it later for more money to compensate you for the loss of purchasing power, right? So when I hear people being like, oh, you know, fiat is going down, so therefore they should buy Bitcoin. I'm like, well, but you can buy land as well. You can buy postage stamps. You can buy shares. You can buy anything that does inflation hedging. It's in the same category as shares. It's in the same category as rare artwork. Any inflation hedging system basically requires a non-monetary object, right? Yeah. There's something that you can buy for a certain amount of money right now and resell for more money later. So, you know, like, I'm always like fascinated by this mentality where it's like, oh, this is somehow not in the same category as buying, like, you know, an index fund or something. Like, no, it is in the same category. That's how it gets inflation hedging power, right? Yeah. Anyway, to tail this off here, this is why I analyze Bitcoin as being this like very highly counter-tradable, non-monetary symbiotic form, rather than this like thing that's like competing with the monetary system.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, we talk about sellability as well. So, you know, that its ability to become money is a lot easier than the mug or, you know, the other thing. It's, you know, as you say, highly tradable as a counter trade system. But something I just wanted to pull on there. So you talk about a dynamic money system will always consume a non-dynamic system. And I wonder if we can look at the relationship between that and something historically like a gold standard or something where at the end of the day, everyone moved off of a gold standard, of a hard money standard, onto a dynamic system around about the same time. And that just kind of, that was an emergent thing. Maybe there were decisions made, but it all just sort of seemed to happen. Is that connected here, where the ability to change the dynamics of the monetary system was more important, more valuable than fixed?
Yeah. I don't claim to be a definitive expert in the history of every element of every era of money, right? There's been many different changes. And just to reiterate this thing about commodity orientations versus credit orientations. Having a credit orientation to money like I do doesn't mean I don't believe that forms of commodity money exist. It's just like when I'm analyzing them, I'm thinking about them in a different way. Right. There's often been, you know, commodity like forms that end up in monetary systems, but that's not necessarily what drives the logic of those systems. Like, people aren't necessarily using those systems because they like see the inherent value, right? Actually, gold's a really good example of this. Like, early examples of gold, people like have no idea what the value of gold is. It's like a piece of metal. Like, how are you supposed to know you don't even know what to do with it. It's not even at all apparent that it has some obvious value. You even find this in Adam Smith, like he's talking about the conquistadors. And admittedly, Adam Smith is not a very good example of like some definitive expert on like, I mean, he was using poor data a lot of the time, but like, you know, he talks about the Spanish conquistadors arriving in South America. And they're like fiending for gold. They're like obsessed by gold. But like the indigenous people are like, these guys are crazy. Like, what's wrong with it? Why are they prepared to literally like give the amount of stuff that we would only accumulate in a year for this like metal that basically only our like leaders like to have around as like jewelry, right? And the reason was is that they're not analyzing the metal, right? The metal is stuck in a systemic structure back in their homeland. Like that, so they're not really interested in like what is the quote unquote intrinsic value of the metal, right? It's not that's not what's driving the system. So this is what something like a credit money mindset starts to help you like think about, right? One of the interesting things with commodity, quote unquote commodity money systems, is that sometimes they're used to constrain the human imagination. Right, or to create this like illusion that our monetary systems are somehow like determined by geology or like God or something, right? Some like natural force that exists outside of human institutions. So the gold standard in some ways is a kind of like vast illusion where you're sort of pretending that what determines your monetary system is like the arbitrary geology of gold, right? Which is like some star explosions happened, you know, eons ago and deposited a certain like element in the earth. And like this should somehow determine the liquidity in our economic system, right? Which if you think about it, is a kind of absurd. Like why, if you are trying to survive on a planet as a being, would you arbitrarily link yourself to like a geological deposit as your means of survival, right? So human societies make choices to sort of arbitrarily limit themselves through imagining they're constrained by something like gold with their monetary system, but they can change it at any point. This is what happened. To be like, why are we doing this still? Why are we engaging in this charade that we need to have somehow have gold? Let's just like drop it and it carries on working, right?
Yeah.
And so this is like, there's a whole politics to the use of commodity-like objects to pretend like you don't have monetary sovereignty, right? Yeah. In reality, in the background of these systems, there's huge like political decisions being made. And so like these gold systems, which are imagined to be commodity money systems, actually are often fiat systems.
Yeah. Well, right? Sorry, just pulling on that. So I agree. And in the sense that, I mean, value is subjective, right? And so the native Indians and the people in South America, they ultimately the gold was worth less to them than the goods that were being supplied. And you know, I mean, this is it could have been muskets in the case of New Zealand. It could have been anything, you know, land for muskets was the classic one here. And I'm looking at this though, and I'm thinking, how does the power dynamics play out? Because I think that's something we can maybe come to as well, because this is all connected, because ultimately, you know, in New Zealand and South America, these different places where a different, you know, the thing that won out was the people who wanted the gold, you know, they had the power. And so looking at it from that perspective, because I do agree around this, and I'm running both scenarios right now as we talk around the credit theory and then also the commodity theory and just trying to see how they fit together. Is it possible that this, the kind of the power dynamics of sound money, you know, coming back to that, is actually going to win out in a physical world, in reality? You know, the people who are able to accumulate power are the ones who are using this better form of money within the global system, if that sort of makes sense. So, you know, I'd say no.
But that said, the reason why, I mean, I don't see Bitcoin as being like gold for a start. Like, I mean, so I would reject the underlying premise that it's like the new gold. But like, you know, actually a lot of like Austrian economists agree with that. Like they're like, well, yeah. There's a certain like subset of Austrian economists who think Bitcoin is like gold, but by no means is that shared across hardcore Austrian economists, right? And I'm definitely not an Austrian economist. I think the Austrian economics' view of money is like atrocious. But that said, you know, I respect there's internal differences within that world about whether Bitcoin even resembles gold, right? But, you know, having said that, I would say, like, in the history of capitalism, there is different moments where different types of monetary systems can work out, right? So actually, maybe in, like, the 18th, 19th century, capitalism expands by having this, like, pseudo-stability of the pseudo-commodity imagination of money, right? Like, it creates a certain kind of, like, imagined stability in the system. And that maybe that can actually be very good for a business environment at a certain point in a system, but that doesn't mean that carries on forever, right? Because capitalism is a dynamic system. It doesn't stay the same. So actually at some point, this is why the charade broke down at some point. It was like, you know, we sort of supposed to be moving gold around international trade, but why? Let's just stop doing it, right? And the system carries on going, right? So hypothetically, even if, for example, you know, there was some like hyper Bitcoinization event or whatever, like, which I can't logically see how it works exactly, but let's imagine it happened. It would by no means stay like that, right? It might stay like that for a little bit and then like revert back, right? So there's no end stable point in a dynamic system. Like and the question becomes is like, to what extent is a system like Bitcoin, for example, able to actually deal with the dynamism of the economy, right? Like it's not necessarily structurally very good at it. So in my analysis, I'd be like, then you shouldn't try to do that. That's not your niche strength. The niche strength of something like Bitcoin to me is it's a symbiotic counterpower form that exists with the existing system. It doesn't ever replace it, right? I think it's a much more realistic and probably more politically useful vision. right? Rather than engaging in these sort of weird abstract imaginations of like how it would replace the existing system, because it's like, I don't think it has the capacity to do that. And even if you, again, to look back at those gold metaphor, the gold things, the gold system didn't exist in isolation. It wasn't just gold, right? Gold is like one element of a gold standard system. It's not like everybody has some universal perception of like gold's value. It actually operates in symbiosis with a whole bunch of fiat dynamics, right? So even the so-called gold standard has large fiat components to it, right? It's not like you switch from gold to fiat and you switch back to some new digital gold, right? There's always symbiotic forms going on, right? And so I think it's useful to break away from those like sort of pure imaginations of these like stable systems. I'm not saying you're doing that, but I certainly see that tendency playing out in lots of debates about, especially in the hardline maxi communities of Bitcoin, which admittedly I no longer take part in.
Look, man, and I appreciate that. And that's part of, again, I think we do have similar backgrounds in terms of that, what we've studied, where we're from. And I think that's where I'm trying to go with this show is, and as close as possible, observe the transformation of value. What is money? These kinds of questions. And sorry, I mean, we talked about that earlier in terms of the definitions and functions, but I'm really interested in taking on new perspectives, and you've really shared a lot about that today. And I guess the idea that it is it's kind of a counterculture within the world, where if you want to buy stuff without anyone knowing, if you want to send money to somebody without the government seeing, it serves a niche role there, certainly. And it's able to transact value in ways where, for example, we've seen with the war in Russia and the SWIFT network being cut off. If you want to send money to your family in Russia, you could send them Bitcoin. And does that role, I mean, that is a function, right? And so that is, I would like to be able to do that if I was in that situation, to send money to my mom, And so that is certainly different to our hyper-Bitcoinized kind of golden orange future.
Yeah, exactly.
But so running with the counterculture model, and this is again connecting to your writing around punk culture, kind of the revolutionary rhetoric and how it gets gentrified. I mean, do you see a role for these kind of modes of transmission of value without barriers, without state intervention, without KYC in that? I mean, how do you see that?
Yeah, look, I mean, okay, so again, if I'm zooming out and I'm doing this like balance of power analysis, as I mentioned earlier, despite my quibbles with the sort of rhetoric internal to the Bitcoin world, which I often find just really problematic, beyond that, it has this counter power role, right? It's this counter trade system that's symbiotic and operates in sort of slightly operates on the margins, right? Which is actually very useful. My concern when I've been doing, because my a large part of my work involves, again, this protecting of the cash system. One of the problems I have found is when, for example, people say to me, "Oh, well, don't worry, Bitcoin solves this." I'm like, that's not true. For the vast majority of people in the world, like, asking them to use a volatile digital commodity rather than the cash system is just not realistic. It's also not very fair, right? So while I agree that it does actually have a counterpower role and it can be useful, it's also the risk sometimes is that people start to like imagine it as a silver bullet, and then start to imagine that like, oh, well, you don't need to like do something like protect the cash system because we've got this sorted. And to me, that's like a counterproductive narrative, right? Because I'm like, no, you actually do need to protect the cash system.
I'm absolutely a cash supporter,
So I'm not saying, actually, interestingly, in the Bitcoin community, there are quite a few people who are sympathetic with that view. There are quite a lot of people who say, actually, we agree on the protection of cash, right? So I'm not trying to claim that this is not a thing, but I have also found this as a tendency among some people to be like, well, you're not going to protect the cash system, so we better just like, use Bitcoin instead. And I just don't think for most people that's a viable option, right? Precisely because of those those speculative counter trade dynamics I mentioned earlier. Like if you're a small business and you're being asked to suddenly use a digital object that shifts in monetary price by like 30% at a time sometimes, it's like it's a very volatile thing to suddenly get involved in, right? So for a lot of you know, especially so it has this like temporary use, right, for like temporary transactions and stuff like that. But for people like to like hold on to it, you know, for a person who's low on money, it's not good for their nervous system.
Yeah.
Right. Because they suddenly see these crashes, these like spikes. So it's like a weird thing to get involved in as a so, you know, whereas for me, like the cash system for the average person, like that's a much more important thing to like, it's equally important to be promoting that than to be I look at it almost like a chessboard of players, right? I'm like, okay, I can see what the Bitcoin system is trying to do. It's like a dark knight over here. That's its role there, but like it shouldn't pretend that it's like the end, be all and end all, right? So there's always other things you got to do as well. And actually, so that means I'm that's a supportive view, right? But it's not like an evangelical view. And so, yeah, I do see there being use in building these systems on the outskirts. But I think I would caution people against like getting this evangelical mindset about it, right? But the cash system. And the one last thing, to this the War on Informality article that you liked and... you know, one of the things I'm talking about in the War on Informality article is the automation fetish. The fact that in our global systems, there is an internal tendency towards acceleration and expansion, right? And in a capitalist system. So the systemic forces always push towards greater speed and greater scale, right? Regardless of what human beings want. At a systemic level, you have these forces that are much more powerful than you as an individual being. So they always push along these expansion and acceleration routes, right? Which is why as soon as you fall into, for example, let's say you start using digital payment, the system will quickly like lock that in and prevent you from being able to go back, right? So it's like a one-way ratchet system. It's like, as soon as you quote unquote choose to go cashless, there's no going back. It's not going to allow you to use cash again, right? So this is what has happening in a capitalist system a lot of the time, right? As soon as it is able to lock in a higher state of acceleration and automation, it will do it, right? And what's interesting in the I'm going to say crypto world here because it actually applies to the crypto world more generally, is people aren't actually going against the acceleration automation impulse. They actually want to go with it, right? These are still digital units. They're digital systems that can be automated. Actually, there's especially in like the Ethereum world, like a massive automation fetish, right? But they kind of like want the automation and gigantic, like interconnected, expanding, accelerating systems to be slightly more decentralized in their power, right? So whereas the cash system work that I do is actually an anti-automation position. Right. I'm saying we can do things that go against the acceleration automation impulse. And this is one point of difference between the pro cash movement and the Bitcoin movement, at least at some level, right? Is that there's a slightly different political vision because actually a lot of people in the crypto world, they might actually support cash, but at some level, they basically will say, we don't really believe that something that's non-automated can survive. Therefore we'll have to make this digital one, right? Whereas I'm like, I believe that something non-automated can survive and not only survive, could actually become more important in the future.
Yeah, I mean, on that note, and I mean, I agree in the sense that, I mean, cash is really, it really is important. And I've seen that firsthand. You know, we had a major flooding in New Zealand last year, and for a while, or for a couple of weeks, there was no power, there was no credit cards, no EFTPOS, none of that stuff. And cash had a premium on it. And you see in the informal economy, it plays a really important role. And it's there's been a huge attack on it, certainly in New Zealand. I often think of the sort of again, we'll come back to Wellington, an extremely left-leaning city, capital of the country, and you've got cafes that don't accept cash, and then you've got people who don't have bank accounts and they are unable to participate in transaction. And so I see that certainly as a problem. I see them, however, the cash and the Bitcoin thing, I mean, they're kind of two tools in the tool set. They're two pieces on the chessboard. But this bigger kind of challenge, this acceleration of payments, kind of the automation, the big data aspect of it's hugely concerning as well. I mean, what are we aiming for here? Is there a political principle around your work more generally in terms of an outcome that you desire? Is it purely documentative? Like what... Where are you sort of?
Yeah, I mean, I just bear in mind when I'm sort of, you know, pointing out these differences, I'm mostly doing it for like categorization reasons, right? Because it's like, I think there are political similarities between, say, for example, you know, a cash position and a Bitcoin position, but there's also differences, right? And as mentioned earlier as well, you know, like, you know, within the Bitcoin world, there's imagined difference with crypto, but actually there's also similarities between Ethereum and Bitcoin. There's similar things going on. So I'm often trying to pick out where the points of difference and similarities lie, right? So as a political impulse, I do believe that like the broad world of decentralized technology tends to accept at some level the overarching trajectory of acceleration and automation, but then says we should try to flatten the power dynamics within that, right? And then there's a whole bunch of differences between those people in that scene, right? But that's one point of commonality at some level, right? I personally, that's not the kind of vision I would rather have a decentralized digital system than a purely centralized one, right? But I also want non-digital stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm also, I guess I have like this kind of like anarchist position at some level, which is I don't think you ever get perfect systems. Maybe this is like an existentialist position, I don't really quite know. But at least in my work around cash, I'm like, balance is a power. It's like I'm trying to protect balance is a power. That's all. It's not like you get some utopia that emerges from protecting the cash system, right? It's just that you prevent a dystopia from emerging at some level.
Yeah.
Like, right. So that's the political objective of the cash work that I do. At a broader level though, I'm like politically interested in how you get people to believe that you can stand against the systemic forces of a capitalist system, or at least to come to terms with what they feel right about that. Because a lot of people don't believe they have any power in the face of the systemic forces, right? And you know, interestingly, I'm just like riffing right now, the rise of conspiracy theories, which is, you know, rife in the world right now. I mean, I would see that very clearly as being like a response to the feeling of powerlessness at systemic forces, right? People like fixate upon like the WEF and like Klaus Schwab as if this person has any power, which they don't, right? Like they have zero power. They're like mere figureheads in a system that doesn't, you know, give a shit about them, right? So the actual problem in capitalist systems is not that there's a bunch of elites that control things. It's that nobody's in control. That's the point, right? And so that's a very hard thing for people to actually get their head around politically. So things like conspiracy theories, for example, offer these very comforting narratives, which is just like, oh, there is actually an identifiable elite. This is them here. And this is, look what they're doing, blah, blah, blah. Right? And then, you know, that gets attached to various political, either right-wing or left-wing agendas, mostly right-wing right now. But I'm like interested in like how you go beyond those kind of like shallow narratives of like elites controlling everything to be like, actually, our problem is much more severe than this, right? If elites truly controlled the system, it would be much easier to fix it. And this is why it's very hard to convey this to people, right? Because people aren't used to thinking like this. I wrote a piece recently, which is called Going Cashless, which is about the rise of conspiracy theories in the cash and CBDC worlds. So I'm always have this problem when I'm doing pro-cash work, because I have to face all these like conspiracy theorists. So a lot of them have become incredibly like reactionary and racist, right? This is related to the rise of quote unquote diagonalism, which is the sort of what some people call like right populism, the sort of movement that tries to believe that it's transcended like left and right politics. And yeah, the likes of Steve Bannon and so on have basically been orchestrating or trying to like promote this movement for a long time, right? And so a lot of my work, a lot of the anti-corporate narrative has been captured by the far right, which used to belong to the left. And this is the diagonalist thing in action. They're just like come in and captured this thing. And like Russell Brand and people are all part of this kind of new alliance, right? So this new conservative movement, which sort of masquerades at some level as being also like left-wing. And so my work on cash is always a problem, right? Because I'm trying to do stuff to show that actually like protecting cash is a progressive thing to do. But you have basically this like incredibly conservative demagogues now who basically captured lots of that narrative, right? That it's like, you know, a Jewish conspiracy or something to like enslave you or blah, blah, blah. The standard like conspiracy tropes. And so I'm finding it quite hard in trying to like hold that critical position in the cash world. But I wrote an article about it which is called Going Cashless in Eon magazine, which says it's long form journalism. And one of the ways I was trying to describe it there is to talk about old witchcraft trials, right? So like, you know, in the 16th century, I speak about a particular case I think it was in Denmark, where, or was it Norway? And where there was a big storm hits this bay, right? And it kills a bunch of guys who are out fishing. And the people go and they blame the storm on a few women. And they're like, you caused the storm. You killed these people, basically. And they got killed. And at that time, they were basically that's a conspiracy mindset, right? You imagine that this storm system was somehow created by these people, right? So whereas nowadays, when we're doing analysis of weather, we say there's a systemic, there's atmospheric pressures, there's things going on, like that's what's caused the storm. You don't need to describe the bad outcomes with reference to bad actors, right? These guys died because of like some systemic thing. And it's similar in the economic system. You don't need to describe the bad outcomes in an economic system with reference to bad actors. In the conspiracy world, they fixate upon bad actors, imagined bad actors like, you know, Augustin Carstens at the Bank of International Settlements wants to destroy you through CBDC. I mean, this is like a delusion, right? Augustin Carstens has no power. Right. He's like, I don't know if you know this guy, but he's like a very common figure. It's like he's like a Mexican economist who has a position in the BIS. He has very zero power in the global system, right? But because he happens to have said a few things, he suddenly becomes this like puppet master figure. The reality is, like, what's actually happening in a systemic level with the storm, as it were, in global capitalism is that like it needs to accelerate, it needs to expand. Those are the systemic pressures. People like Augustin Carstens merely become like conduits via which that kind of stuff happens, right? And if he doesn't go along with it, he gets fired, right? Because he, like, almost in an evolutionary sense, will like find himself out of a job, right? And this is a very hard thing to convey to people, that actually you don't need to describe, for example, the destruction of the cash system with reference to like Bill Gates, right? What's actually happening is a systemic force where there is like, and it's a systemic force where large players benefit more than smaller players, right? So there are beneficiaries to that, but it doesn't mean they're fully in control. And that's a much harder position to convey than me just going out being like, the elites want to oppress you, right? And so that's what I'm struggling with a lot in terms of like, how do you build a kind of like progressive narrative around this stuff, which actually doesn't end up in cranky ass conspiracy theories.
Oh, I mean, I hear you, man. And I know there's a lot of stuff out there. And we've kind of got another vector here, which is just the increased connectivity of social media. You've got AI bots now, you know, spewing bullshit. And I was reading another article that someone else wrote just around, you know, the future of kind of propaganda now and sort of truth and these kinds of questions, which have always been there. But it's now like, well, fuck, you can't trust anything that's coming through your screen.
Yeah, exactly. Or it's amplifying all that stuff.
And I think, I guess, you know, sort of moving towards wrapping this up a little bit, but I guess what I'm interested in, I mean, I mean, these are big questions, and I'm coming back to sort of the real use cases of, I guess, the lived experience. And I think trying to ground that a little bit, and it's kind of a bit problematic when I look at New Zealand and I think, man, it all works, right? Your EFTPOS cards, you could use cash some places if you want, these kinds of things. There is a systematic change that is making things go cashless. There is also a systematic change that's making people want to not have their shit tracked and to be able to do what they want to do. And that's, there's no doubt about that, right? There's people out there who want to be self-sovereign, and to
No,
use
sure.
some Bitcoin language there. So those forces are sort of starting, those waves are starting to, connect and kind of bounce around. And how does that all play out? I mean, do you see, US dollar, just on a real reality check here, is the US dollar going to take over? Is there going to be always a plurality of nation state currencies as we accelerate? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the way to approach any of these questions is to like just hold multiplicity and contradiction in mind as a basic the grounding of everything, right? Like, there's a terrible tradition in like Western philosophy of like seeking stability, like object-oriented philosophy. It's like, and this is like, I'm getting very abstract right now, but it's a massive trend, like a historical tendency in like a lot of like Enlightenment thinking. It's like seeking out stable pictures of things, and then there's like a change, and then there's a change, and then it becomes a new stable thing. All right, so but the base level like starting point is also always some like imagined stable thing that then changes to a new stable thing. The reality is that there is the middle point. The reality is that everything is always actually like symbiotic and changing and never stable, right? And like that's a much better starting point to any kind of analysis. And there's always a multiplicity. So yeah, it's like all these things are possible, right? But like I think the thing to avoid doing in any analysis is to trying to imagine these stable end states. Like, and for example, in the case of the Bitcoin world, I've already critiqued like the absurd kind of like some of those maxi visions are just like totally delusional to me, right? It's much more interesting when you start to be like, okay, let's think about this in sort of ecosystem terms, right? Like, where in this Bitcoin is not separate from the ecosystem. It has some ecosystem type of like element going on. So let's work with that rather than denying it, right? And so yeah, if you're like, for example, trying to build out new forms of like digital autonomy, yes, there is definitely some like role there, right, in the Bitcoin world. But I would never engage in the like delusion that somehow is going to like, disrupt the US dollar. When it comes to like large scale monetary politics, yeah, there's probably going to be big differences going forward there, right? Especially with the rise of like, US China battles and stuff like that, right? Like, where, and this is where stable coins actually, I would say, are becoming very interesting and probably like dangerous and important and problematic, which is like, actually, when you're looking at de facto global monetary politics, my family in Zimbabwe, for example, my family's from Zimbabwe. Like, they're not going to use Bitcoin. I mean, maybe sometimes they're far more likely to use a US dollar stablecoin. When it actually comes to the real lived experience of, like, for example, being a farmer in Zimbabwe, like, and they say, okay, well, we want to hold our, we don't necessarily, like, if there's suddenly a US dollar stablecoin that becomes available, that becomes something that's actually potentially interesting and useful to a commercial farmer, and that poses a problem for the monetary sovereignty of smaller countries in a global economic order where they're like marginal players. So to truly understand like global monetary politics, you also have to understand like colonialism and like the power differentials between countries. So, in lots of these sort of, for example, like Latin American countries, they view the US as being imperialistic, right?
Well, it is. And I mean, I'm from a
Yeah,
small
it's
country, man. You don't have to
Yeah,
sell me on
exactly. So
that. So.
this is the thing. It's not like there's equality between the fiat systems of the world, right? You have hierarchy, right? And so actually people are saying like, we don't want US dollar stable coins to undermine our local system, such that like, even if like a local business owner, for example, thinks that it's worth their while holding US dollar stable coins, it's undermining at some level your national government. Now, like, if you're a libertarian, maybe like, well, that's good. You're undermining the national government. But it's like, well, then you're becoming subject to US imperial power. How is that like better? right? So there's like a lot of that kind of analysis in the global monetary system. Like a lot of people, for example, you know, I got a friend, Andres Arauz, who's a former central banker in Ecuador. This is a huge issue. It's like, we don't want the US system controlling our country, right? Visa and MasterCard being the only forms of like payment that you can have, right? Where basically our citizens have no rights in the US, and whereas US citizens do have rights, right? So we're going to be subject to American corporations. So for them, building like local monetary autonomy is important, right? And that doesn't mean becoming part of the Bitcoin system. That means building their own national currency, right? So I think that's how, like, when I'm analyzing these systems, I'm like, there's always these sort of weird like sub battles going on and stuff like that. But I guess the sort of meta battle at some level is between like US and China, right? So if I was thinking about a strategy for Bitcoin going forward, I'd be like, think about how it plays into that situation, and like be realistic about its position within that structure. You know, I'm not that you're asking for advice on Bitcoin strategy.
You talk about starting principles, and as I said at the beginning, I'm in Japan. I appreciate the Chinese, Eastern philosophy, generally speaking. I mean, it comes from a place of Tao, as they say. You know, it's a state of flow. It's not an absolute, and so. Or, I mean, I know what you mean. You know, it's never just a point in time. It's always a dynamic. And so that is a place to look at. It's again, it's cultural hegemony. It's things are moving and the shapes are changing, and that's the oil on the water. And as also, you know, coming from New Zealand, where I did an episode recently really breaking down some of the recent central bank announcements and discussions that are happening in New Zealand. And something that came through is that they don't really give a shit about Bitcoin, but they do give a shit about stable coins because the New Zealand dollar, you know, I mean, we're an export-oriented country. There's actually a challenge there because, you know, I want US dollars. You know, clients pay me. Give me USD over NZD any day of the week. And that actually, you know, long-term, that means that your country becomes subservient to the military power, the financial power of Washington, which is, you know, problematic. It's kind of neo-empire, neo-colonialism in that sense.
Yeah.
So there's certainly a discussion there.
This is also why, like sort of anarchist-y ways of thinking, which, and I'll use that term cautiously, but where it's about like you're trying to play off different types of power against each other is quite useful, right? Because you're not necessarily imagining an end state where you escape from power at some point. It's like, how do you, like...
You know, what's beneficial right now? And so...
Yeah, well, how do you create counterpowers and things like that, you know? And so that's useful.
Yeah. And look, man, I think that's sort of what I've really taken out of this conversation. And I certainly think this is a valuable counterpower to a lot of the narrative out there around Bitcoin and sort of this kind of category of topic, because there is a lot of nuance to it. And I call it Bitcoinism, but generally the political science of this changing thing that's happening right now, where, you know, who knows what the fuck's going to happen? You know, how does the US and China, you know, how does that all play out? What are the Russians going to use to sell their oil? Is it going to be Bitcoin? Is it gold? Is it this? Is it that? I think there's some really interesting conversations in there. And if it means that I personally benefit from it, and you know, then that would be great. And if it means that we have money that can't be just shut off, if our quality of life can increase, if we can have all those things as well, that would be nice. I don't know. Any sort of final thoughts on that, sort of wrapping it up, and then we can...
I mean, look, I think if people want to... I mean, maybe if your listeners want to like check out more stuff on alternative money positions that, for example, I have on my Substack, I do have these big pieces around that. They're pretty big pieces. Like, you got to like devote like an hour or so to like wade, you know, to get into them, because I sometimes have these big geeky pieces like that. But I did one on designing the Moneyverse like a couple months ago, which was looking at all the different paradigms of alternative currency beyond, say, the crypto world. So becoming aware of those kind of things, I think, is useful, just to sort of see how, like something like if you're a Bitcoiner, for example, how your style of thinking relates to other styles of thinking. So you can sort of be aware of the landscape that existed prior to it. I have another piece called Zero is the Future of Money, which is about credit money systems as an alternative. And I do critique of Bitcoin in there. But again, like the I have this chessboard type of approach, right? Which is like, I can see where the ecosystem sits in the overall picture. But then I'm advocating that we need to go beyond that to something different, right? I think like being aware of all the different styles of alternative currency and the politics of them, I think is a really good thing. But then also being aware how all of those at some level are subsumed within this much broader system, right? So I'm always analyzing them in relation to the much more powerful dominant systems, very useful very practically useful, right? So like that's what good currency designers do, is they say, like, let's realistically look at what ecosystem this new thing is going to be put into and how it'll interact with the main system. And that becomes very interesting once you actually take that mindset on, because you can start to get more, practical about what you're doing. Now I'm picking up from your stuff. That's the kind of vibe that you have, right? So that's good.
Yeah, well, I mean, they said to me on the first day at university in Wellington that by the end of this degree, you will all be Marxists. And so I've been inoculated against that. I've been through it.
I mean, one thing I'll say is I have a Marxist vibe in my overall analysis, but I mean, in my money stuff, I don't.
No.
Right. So actually there's a whole other discussion, which we haven't really had around like proper, you know, the depths of like monetary stuff, which we kind of touched on a little bit in this conversation. But it is useful to, in some ways, you know, Austrian economics and Marxism actually in a weird way agree with each other on money in some level as a commodity, right? Whereas like the actual monetary tradition I come from is much more like David Graeber, anthropology, credit theories of money, chartalism, stuff like that, which is nowadays like the sort of most well-known version of that thinking in the US is the MMT movement. I'll actually be doing an MMT podcast later today.
Oh, okay.
That's an incredibly powerful body of monetary thought.
Yeah.
Right. It gets vilified, but it's way more advanced than for example Marxist monetary thought.
Yeah, I'm very interested in MMT. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a very useful perspective to understand, because especially if you're interested in, you know, weirdly, and again, I don't want to straw man the Bitcoin community, but there's a tendency in the Bitcoin community to like vilify something like MMT as being this like terrible state thing to like just, you know, print money. But actually the MMT framework is a descriptive framework for understanding money, right? It has prescriptive elements that can be added on, but at base, it's a descriptive system. And it's related to this much broader tradition I spoke about, which is a credit thinking of money. I didn't necessarily think like, I wouldn't necessarily say credit theories of money, but credit like credit thinking, credit orientation. There's a certain like vibe about thinking about money. And I think it's super useful to learn that stuff if you are interested in commodity systems, right? Because it actually helps you to think about how you would make a commodity system work if you understand the credit theories or the credit like orientation. So I think it's really useful to understand those ones. And actually there's a bunch of financial traders, for example, who really love like chartalism and stuff, precisely because it gives them a massive edge when they're actually analyzing existing monetary systems.
Yeah. Well, no, look, man, I think this has been really useful. And for me, again, this is sort of reaffirmed where I'm wanting to take the show, which is strong beliefs held lightly, plurality of thinking, different lenses, and really looking at the stuff that's happening, because there is, you know, real affect in the world. We can see what is taking place, but then being able to kind of analyze that without being dogmatic about it, because there's certainly dogma in all sort of areas, and it's a human tendency, I believe. So it takes quite a lot of effort to move beyond that. As you know, so sort of, you know, having these kind of different lenses that you can use, different filters for viewing the thing, because ultimately we're talking about the economy here. It is everything.
You
know, it's sort of quite encompassing, and to see it all, it's impossible, right? So you just sort of, you need to wear different filters. So I appreciate your time and putting up my Bitcoin talk, but I think I would love to catch up with you again sometime. Hopefully maybe I can get over to Germany sometime even. You know, talk a bit more about this stuff. And I'm going to read a few more of your pieces on your Substack that you just mentioned and sort of dive into that, because I think it's an emerging thing. It's kind of a new thing within Bitcoin. You know, it's not that old. And so it's sort of, there's an opportunity to really sort of study it and look at it through these different filters, which I find quite
exciting. Sure, sure. Well, yeah, thanks for having me on.
No, thank you. And yeah, good luck with your other podcast today. And yeah, we'll keep in touch. All right.
Cool,
thank
cool.
you, Brett. Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.